Half a mile beyond the Bekeng are the ruins of Angkor Thom, a partly destroyed road hidden beneath sand and dust, crossing a vast ditch choked with blocks of stone, fragments of sculptured lions and elephants, leads to a gateway, built like a triumphal arch. At the top are four immense heads, every available space filled with sculpture. And within this vast enclosure, now covered with an almost impenetrable forest, lie buildings in ruin, which testify to the ancient splendor of the town. Seeing the Temple of Angkor, the most beautiful and best preserved of all the remains, makes him forget all the fatigues of the journey, and fills him with admiration and delight, such as would be experienced on finding a verdant oasis in the sandy desert. Suddenly, as if by enchantment, he seems transported from barbarism to civilization, from profound darkness to light. But what has become of this powerful race, the authors of these gigantic works? A rival to that of Solomon, grander than anything left to us by Greece or Rome, presenting a sad contrast to the state of barbarism in which the nation is now plunged. The account here, written down by the explorer Henri Mouhot in the mid-1800s, reads like someone who has stumbled across the ultimate example of a lost civilization, as if it were pulled from fiction. A vanished empire whose ancient people must have been suddenly swallowed up by the jungle, like the remains of the stone temples that he was describing. He explicitly makes clear that a greatness had been lost, implying that whoever had built this city had disappeared. And that cliched story actually took root. Even today, it's still a trope which gets repeated. But it simply wasn't true. Angkor was never lost, and it certainly didn't require someone to sail over from Europe to discover it. Its grand temple was never empty, and the remains of the city that had once spread across the landscape hadn't been suddenly abandoned in some cataclysmic event. Mouhot, although he never actually claimed to have discovered the temple complex himself, would become an important figure in spreading word to the West about the ruins that still stood near the Great Lake of Cambodia. Some accounts even claimed he had accidentally stumbled upon them while chasing butterflies, which again is very far from the truth. You only need to read his diary to know that he was guided there by someone that had previously known the location, and that the ruins were still indeed known to the locals themselves. But what he was standing in front of, even in its ruined, overgrown, centuries-abandoned state, was enough to stop him in his tracks. Enough to make him reach for comparisons to Solomon, to Greece and Rome, just to find some frame of reference for the scale of what he was seeing. So how did it get there? How does a landscape of rice farmers and river traders and local chiefs become this? One of the largest, most ambitious, most technically extraordinary urban civilizations the medieval world had ever produced. That's what this episode is about. The period from roughly the 9th century to the 13th, the kings of Angkor, who built it, the water systems that sustained it, the temples that still stand there today, and the civilization that was, for a few centuries at least, doing something almost no one else on Earth was doing at the same scale. By the end of it, we'll be standing at the peak of the Khmer Empire. Jayavarman II, the man who had established the Khmer Empire, performed the Devaraja ceremony on Phnom Kulen, and was declared a universal monarch, the king above all kings, he died at Hariharalaya in 835 CE. That city was named after Harihara, the fusion of Shiva and Vishnu that we encountered in part 1. The city had been built on the already existing village of Rulos, around 10 kilometers southeast of modern Siem Reap. If you visit today, you'll pass it on the road into town. It sits on a flat plain closer to the extent of the Great Lake, and even from satellite imagery, you can still see the vast areas of rice paddies stretching toward the banks of the Tonle Sap and some outlines of the city that was built there. The contrast with where Jayavarman II had started this project, up on Phnom Kulen, is immediately apparent. This is exactly the kind of landscape that the mountain simply couldn't provide. It was wide, flat, fertile, and close to way more water. The remains of this city, what visitors today now call the Roulos group of temples, are beautiful, early statements of what was to come. But it was not Jayavarman's son who would really push things forward. Jayavarman III ruled, hunted elephants, and apparently did his job wisely enough, but history has not left us much more than that. Instead, it was his successor who would monumentalize the power of this new empire. Indravarman, he was not the son of the king, but likely a nephew of Jayavarman II's queen, a reminder that succession was not always a straight line from father to son in the Khmer world. Well, he took the throne in 877. And if Jayavarman II had given the kings who came after him the concept of the universal monarch, then Indravarman gave them something equally important, a blueprint for how to construct their reign. An inscription boasts that almost immediately after his coronation, within 5 days, he had ordered the excavation of an immense rectangular reservoir. This was the Indratataka, the Sea of Indra. Around 4 kilometers long and 800 meters wide, it was eventually capable of holding roughly 7.5 million cubic meters of monsoon water. To get a sense of the scale, imagine around 450 football pitches laid side by side. In terms of water, it was the equivalent of more than 150,000 average backyard swimming pools. Nothing on this scale had been attempted in the region before. The coordination of labor, knowledge and royal authority required to produce it is genuinely staggering. And like the water systems being developed on Phnom Kulen, this reservoir carried meaning beyond just its practicality. Though sacred oceans surrounding Mount Meru, the cosmic mountain at the center of the Hindu universe, were being physically expressed in the landscape. The reservoir, the moats, the temple mountains that would come to define Angkor, all of it was rooted in this idea of recreating the cosmic order on Earth. And if we imagine for a moment in this world where water was so important, symbolically, practically, and these kings were now creating these, let's be real, even by today's standards, absolutely huge artificial lakes, well, this must have been such a visceral example of their power, a symbol of their royal authority, as these sacred, life-giving reservoirs provided so much to the people and the city. We'll come back to the question of just how central these reservoirs were to the functioning of Angkor and supporting its population, because there has been some debate on the matter, but for now, what is key to remember is that this waterworks was the first move in what was becoming a very deliberate set of moves for the new Khmer kings. By the time Indravarman's capital at Hariharalaya was taking shape, a 3-step construction pattern was established. First, the waterworks. A vast reservoir securing the plain, anchoring the city in both agriculture and cosmology, the Barai. Then they would build a large temple for their ancestors. This made the royal lineage permanent in brick and stone. And finally, the construction of a state temple, a mountain raised in the capital where the king's authority aligned itself with the gods. Preah Ko, the temple of the sacred bull, was the ancestral temple in this arrangement. Consecrated in 879 or 880 CE, its 6 brick towers honoured Indravarman's parents, his grandparents, and at its heart, Jayavarman II himself and his wife. When we think about this, bringing the ancestors into the geometry and construction of the city, we might be reminded of the animism of the Khmer, the power and spirituality they afford physical spaces and features. And Jayavarman II being this embodiment of the contract that had established this new kingly order. And for a succession of kings, they were trying to reflect their own connection to this figure, legitimizing their rule by virtue of his. Now, inside the towers stood statues of those ancestors in the forms of gods. Now, just to the south of Preah Ko, you can see the Bakong, a stepped pyramid set within a double moat, built with sandstone brought down from Phnom Kulen. At its summit, a linga marking the vertical axis between earth and heaven. The shape is the one that will define Angkor, the temple mountain in full articulation. As I said, Mount Meru brought down to the lowland plain. And the double moat around it represents the cosmic ocean that surrounds Mount Meru. Within these moats, there would have been wooden halls, storage structures, ritual spaces, the everyday infrastructure of a royal capital, priests and officials moving between them, as well as regular people. Today, we can lose sight of how lived in these areas would have been, because we're just left with a moat and a stone temple. The king's own residence, the palace, was built separately to these structures, most likely in timber, following the same precedent that had been established on Phnom Kulen, and much before that as well. None of that timber has survived, as it very rarely does, but the raised earthen platform that the palace once sat upon is still faintly visible, if you know where to look. Altogether, this three-pronged building program brought together water, lineage, and a cosmic center of it all, held together with a large, not very dense urban area, but a still highly planned space. And this was the formula. It was working. It just hadn't been quite perfected yet. But we still need to remember that this was just the capital city. The reach of Indravarman's power extended far beyond just the plain north of the Great Lake. Inscriptions associated with his reign appear well beyond Rulos, far into the northwest of what is now modern-day Thailand, and well into the southeast, into what is modern-day South Vietnam. Whether these were tightly controlled territories or more loosely aligned relationships is hard to say, but the sense of scale of the new empire was coming into view. One inscription describes Indravarman as steadier than the sun, a lion among kings. Their language is very poetic, but it also conveys something quite real, a court that was conscious of expansion and confident about it. By the end of his decade on the throne, Hariharalaya had settled into a form that later generations would recognize, build upon, and eventually surpass. The experiment that had begun on a mountaintop with Jayavarman II was now taking shape on the floodplain itself. When Indravarman died in 889 CE, the transition was not a smooth one. Now, the inscriptions are a little light on the details, but later traditions hint at conflict between his sons. Some accounts even speak of naval battles on the Tonle Sap itself between them. However it did play out, what emerges on the other side is the new king. He took the royal name Yashovarman, protected by glory, at his coronation around 889 or 890. Now, his first moves as king are quite telling. Rather than immediately pouring everything into a single monument at the capital, he spread his presence across the landscape. He established a series of religious retreats, ashramas, throughout his realm. Each one was consecrated and endowed with land grants, duties, and regulations that were recorded on stone pillars that thankfully still survive. When you plot these pillars onto a map, they stretch from the Angkor region down into southeastern Cambodia, out toward what is now northwestern Thailand, and up to the region of Wat Phu in present-day Laos. It's essentially a map of the kingdom, and a statement that this king's authority wasn't just centered on a single city, but networked across a vast territory, kind of like an empire. What's also notable is that these retreats were consecrated for different religious communities, followers of Shiva or Vishnu and Buddhist alike, which tells you something about how this court operated. Rather than imposing a single tradition, Yashovarman was cultivating relationships across all of them. Think of it a little like a politician today making sure to show up at the opening of a mosque, a cathedral, a synagogue. It's politics as much as piety, a way of binding different communities into a single loyal network, and the importance of maintaining this was paramount. Back at Hariharalaya, however, he completed his father's great reservoir and built a small temple on an artificial island at its center. Four brick towers rising from the water, dedicated to his parents. An example of the ancestral part of the building pattern. But also, from the northeastern corner of this reservoir, he laid out a raised causeway running northwest across the plain to a new city. The decision to relocate the capital was probably not down to any one single reason. Evans and Co. suggest that economic, military, religious, and political considerations all overlapped. Archaeological surveys have also shown that both Hariharalaya and Phnom Kulen had already experienced periods of erosion and hydraulic strain. Water channels had clogged, embankments had worn down. Whether that was the decisive reason or just one factor among many is still up for debate, but it does suggest that these earlier sites had begun to show their limits with hydraulic engineering quite quickly, and it may foreshadow problems that would come centuries later at Angkor itself. The new site lay roughly halfway between the Kulen Range and the shores of the Great Lake, along the Siem Reap River. It was wide, open, and capable of being reshaped on a monumental scale. Yasovarman named it Yasodharapura, the glory-bearing city. At its center rose a natural hill, and he built a temple on top of it, Phnombekeng. The inscriptions here call it the Central Mountain. When you climb it today, even through the crowds and the heat, you get a sense of why this place was chosen. The plain stretches out in every direction. You can see Phnom Kulen. The geometry of the temple itself is astounding. 5 tiers rising to a summit of towers, 108 shrines arranged across the terraces with geometric precision. The whole structure is aligned in the cardinal directions. And you can imagine back then how overwhelming this would have been to someone approaching it from below, where you could see this huge staircase flanked by 2 giant stone lions as you walked past it. It was, in effect, a mountain of stone lifting from the plain, each level drawing the eye upward toward the sky. The temple was dedicated in 907 CE, and at its summit would have stood a linga of Shiva, that vertical axis between earth and heaven, now raised on a hill at the center of the new capital. To the northeast of this beautiful temple mountain, Yasovarman constructed his reservoir, the East Barai. Nearly 8 kilometers long and almost 2 kilometers wide, it dwarfed everything that had come before it. French archaeologists once calculated that the embankments alone would have required millions of person days of labor. Now, whatever that precisely means, or whatever the precise figure was, it gives you a sense of the coordination involved in this project. When full, it would have been a vast sheet of water that reflected the sky, a horizontal counterpart to the vertical mountain at the city's center. Along its southern shore, Yasovarman built monasteries dedicated to Shiva, Vishnu, and the Buddha. The same attentiveness here, built with multiple traditions in mind, at the water's edge. By the time this king died in 910 CE, the essential shape of Angkor had been set. A hill at the center, a vast reservoir to the east, a river running through it. The plain stretched in every direction from here, waiting to be filled. Now it's worth pausing here on what kind of city this actually was, because it's easy to picture Angkor as this gleaming stone complex rising from the jungle and miss what was actually going on back then around it. Angkor was overwhelmingly an agrarian city. Something like 80% of its population worked the land in some form. While the priests, administrators, artisans, and royal retainers who made up the rest all depended entirely on what the agricultural population produced. And the landscape they were working with, as we covered in part one, was one of extremes. Months of intense monsoon rain, followed by months of near drought. Mastering that cycle was everything if you wanted to feed and support a huge population. Which brings us back to those vast reservoirs, the Barai, and a debate that was running for decades around what exactly they were for. If you look at an aerial map of Angkor today, or satellite images, from the air, the Barais look almost abstract. Enormous rectangular imprints on the landscape. The East Barai stretches nearly 8 kilometers, the west, which will be built later, is even bigger than that, and together there will be 4 great reservoirs holding something close to 100 million cubic meters of water. The question that has given archaeologists something to mull over for a lot of the 20th century was quite simple. What were they for? How did they function? In the mid-20th century, the French archaeologist Bernard-Philippe Grolier proposed that Angkor was fundamentally a hydraulic city, that these reservoirs were the engine of an immense irrigation network, capable of supporting perhaps 1 million, maybe even 2 million people, making it, without doubt, the largest pre-industrial city in the world. The rice that that system produced, he argued, fed the court, temples, artisans, and the vast labor force that was to build the monuments that are still famous today. It's a compelling idea, but it did run into some pretty serious criticism. Other archaeologists pointed out that the surviving records from the Angkor period had no mention of the Barais being used for irrigation, And, more practically, they argued that you couldn't find any inlets and outlets to these great bodies of water. How were they getting water in and out of them? It wasn't a working irrigation system. Essentially, their counter-argument to the hydraulic city hypothesis was that the briars were simply symbolic. They were cosmological statements rather than functional infrastructure, and they represented those sacred oceans surrounding Mount Meru. But in the early 2010s, LIDAR changed the picture again. The same technology that revealed Mahendraparvata on Phnom Kulen was applied across the entire Angkorian plain. And what it showed was that the space between the stone monuments wasn't empty, it was a vast, low-density urban landscape extending hundreds of square kilometres, crisscrossed with canals, embankments, and feeder channels. Critically, for the argument that was had over the Barais, they found permanent inlets and outlets in several of the Barai. A major canal ran northward into the hills, feeding a distributor network across the entire plain. What had looked like isolated, symbolic reservoirs now appeared to be part of a managed water system on a scale that nobody had fully appreciated yet. Now, that doesn't mean that Grolier's population estimates were correct. Most scholars today think 2 million is way too high, and even 1 million might be a bit generous. But the basic point stands. Water management was the foundation on which everything else rested, and the Barais were key to that. Here's the simple version of what I'm talking about. The Khmer had mastered the land and water. That mastery produced reliable rice harvests. Reliable harvests fed a growing population. A large population meant more labour, more specialisation, more people available to build, administrate, worship, fight wars, and trade. And all of that surplus, of food, of labour, of wealth, is what would end up making the entire city possible. The stone monuments that still stand today are essentially the crystallized output of a society that had learned, over centuries, to make the land and its waters work for them. However, it would be a mistake to imagine all of this as a smooth linear rise, with each king enlarging, embellishing, or adding another reservoir, another temple, and another layer of grandeur. But it didn't unfold like that. When Yasovarman died around 910 CE, the succession is a bit murky. Seemingly, two of his sons ruled quite briefly, and then within a decade, a rival emerged. A relative by marriage established himself far to the northeast at a place called Koh Kher, 100 kilometres from Angkor, in a harsher, more forested landscape in what is now Priya Vihear province. By the 920s, he was behaving as a king, and by 928 CE, he had declared himself Jayavarman IV. And for 20 years, the centre of the Khmer world shifted away from Angkor entirely. What he built at Koh Kher, although short-lived, was pretty impressive. More than 40 temples rose there in little more than two decades. It was an attempt to recreate what had been done at Yasodharapura very quickly, and at the centre of it all stood Prasat Thom, reminiscent of Mayan pyramids, very stepped in nature, and originally topped with an enormous linga that was said to surpass anything that had come before it. However, the landscape that all of this was being built on was working against the new capital. Koh Kher sat in a region less naturally suited to the kind of large-scale rice agriculture that had underpinned Angkor's growth. And for all the ambition of its waterworks, which in scale were an attempt to rival what had been built at Angkor, the engineering seemed to have had a critical flaw. The largest dam appears to have been poorly built. Even moderate rainfall may have been enough to cause structural failure. Evans and Co. suggest that these hydraulic weaknesses, combined with the ecological limits of the region, help explain why the experiment at Koh Kher didn't last. It's an early reminder of something we'll keep coming back to in this story, that in this world, a city was only as strong as its relationship with water. If Mother Nature wasn't kind, or if things weren't built quite correctly, things could turn sour pretty quickly. Within a generation, the political centre returned south to Yasodharapura again. Rajendravarman II re-established himself at Angkor in 944 CE, and he was careful about how he did it. He didn't present himself as the founder of something new. He consciously echoed Yashovarman, the man who had fixed the capital in its location in the first place. He built again in the middle of a reservoir, honouring his ancestors, anchoring kingship back in its ritual landscape here. In this period, the charming little temple of Prerup was built, rising in tiers of brick and sandstone above the plain, another highlight to visit today. His reign appears largely stable. There was a successful campaign against Champa to the east, trade expanded westward, and Buddhism continued to flourish alongside Shivaite worship. Rajendravarman himself appears to have studied Buddhist texts, and one of his chief officials was a prominent Buddhist figure. Although the great Buddhist foundations and temples that would eventually transform Angkor were still a few centuries away. When he died in 968, his son, Jayavarman V, was still quite young, and it seems that much of the early governance rested with senior officials and extended family networks. And it was during his reign that the stunning temple of Bontiai Srei was finished and dedicated. While it is smaller in scale than some of the other great temple mountains, it's carved from a beautiful pink sandstone with a level of delicacy that still stops visitors in their tracks today. And much of this design and architecture was apparently due to the work of a high official who later became the king's tutor. Many consider this temple to be the finest artistic achievement of the entire classic Angkor period. So, by the end of the 10th century, Angkor had been restored and was expanding again, but a period of turbulence was about to follow. When Jayavarman V died around 1001 CE, the succession was again not a smooth one. For several years, the kingdom appears to have been divided, rival claimants holding different regions at once. And in the north, a prince named Suryavarman was consolidating support. He didn't take power in a single decisive moment. The inscriptions suggest a gradual advance toward Angkor over a number of years, built on alliances, marriages, negotiations, and intermittent fighting. Only after this slow consolidation did he finally defeat his last rival and take the capital. By 1011 CE, he'd triumphed. And what he did next tells you a great deal about how power actually worked in this period. He called hundreds of officials to the capital to swear an oath of personal allegiance to him, sealed with blood. And the promise ran both ways. Those who remained loyal would be rewarded with religious foundations to administer, land to draw surplus from, provisions for their families. And this is one of the most important things to understand about how Cambodia worked, not just at Angkor, but across much of its history, perhaps right up until the present. Power here doesn't operate primarily through formal institutions and bureaucratic structures, in the way we might picture it. It operated through personal relationships, through chains of obligation and patronage that link people at every level of society to someone above them and someone below them. Think of it less like a government back then and more like a vast web of favours, debts and loyalties. A village elder owed allegiance to a regional chief, the chief owed allegiance to a court official, that official owed allegiance to the king. And at each link in that chain, loyalty flowed upward in exchange for protection, land and status flowing downward. This also helps explain something that might otherwise seem puzzling, how a kingdom centred on Angkor could exercise such authority over places as far away as northeastern Thailand or Laos. It wasn't primarily about military garrisons or direct administrative control. It was about whether the right people in those places had been properly brought into the network of patronage, whether their loyalty had been secured and maintained through the right kinds of reward. As I said, it's a pattern that reoccurs throughout this entire series and one to keep an eye on. But back to Suryavarman I. He had a long reign, and Evans and Co. consider him to be one of the classic period's greatest builders. In practical terms, Khmer power now stretched well beyond the Cambodian heartland. The western edge of the empire was no longer loose or contested. It was anchored deep inside territory that today lies firmly within Thailand. One temple that Evans and Co. highlight to show this was in Priavihear. It sits on the edge of the Dangrek mountain range, the escarpment that now forms the border between Cambodia and Thailand, and the temple is roughly 500 metres above the plain. It was built over 3 centuries, but much of the work seems to have been done under Suryavarman I. The temple and a few others along the mountain range has been the subject of some pretty bad diplomatic tension between the Thai and Cambodian governments over the last 50 years or so, which itself is a reminder of how much this history still matters in the region today. Back at Angkor, the hydraulic works were expanded again, reservoirs were maintained, channels extended, reflecting a growing population and more land under cultivation. The West Barai, a perfectly rectangular reservoir more than 8 kilometres long, was constructed during his reign. It's partly silted up today, but it still catches the light beautifully at sunset when viewed from Phnom Bekeng. The inscriptions from this period refer to a growing number of settlements as pura cities, pointing toward an increasingly dense administrative landscape. Trade became more visible too, with merchants from Champa, China and beyond appearing more frequently in the record. Forest goods moved outward, while cloth and ceramics, things like that, moved in. And one small but interesting detail worth noting on this economic administration is that unlike many of the great trading civilizations of the ancient world, Angkor operated largely without a standard currency. Land, rice, livestock, and labor were exchanged through negotiated relationships or using cloth, pieces of gold or silver, or slaves, rather than a standardized coin. Interestingly, though, coinage had been used in the pre-classic period. It's unclear exactly why that was not continued into the Angkorian era, but recently some scholars have even pointed to this lack of coin currency being one of the contributing factors to the transformation and even the decline of the Khmer Empire that we'll detail in the next episode. In any case, by the end of Suryavarman I's reign, Angkor was more expansive and more tightly held than it had been in generations. But before we keep following the story forward, it's worth pausing to picture the broader world that this empire was being built within. To the east was a people we've already mentioned a few times, Champa, on a land stretching across the coast of what is now central and southern Vietnam. Now, as with the concepts of Funan and Chenla that we touched upon in part one, it's worth noting that some historians, Michael Vickery among them, have questioned whether Champa as a unified kingdom was really the case. Something more fragmented that got bundled under one name may be the case, but whatever its internal shape, its presence as a rival force was real and persistent. The Chams were skilled seafarers and traders, and they had been rivals of the Khmer for generations. What made them a persistent and difficult rival was partly cultural and partly geographical. Culturally, they weren't so different from the Khmer. Some Hindu traditions, Sanskrit inscriptions, temple building, similar royal conventions. In many ways, they were drawing from the same well. But their economy worked completely differently. Where Angkor's power rested on controlling land, water, and rice, Cham power rested on the sea. They were plugged into maritime trade routes connecting China, India, and the Arab world, routes that Angkor could only access indirectly. That gave them a different kind of resilience. You couldn't simply take their capital and expect the kingdom to collapse, because their strength wasn't concentrated in one place the way Angkor's was. At different times, one side gained the upper hand, but neither eliminated the other. And that tension runs through much of what comes next in the story. Now, further north was Dai Viet, centred in the Red River Delta around present-day Hanoi. It's worth knowing a little about who they were. This was a kingdom that had spent nearly 1,000 years under Chinese rule before finally winning its independence in 938 AD. By the time Suryavarman was pushing against them in the 12th century, you were dealing with a people who had just fought their way free from the most powerful empire in the world. They were organised, confident, and very much in the business of defending what they had. Campaigns in that direction were never simple. The terrain was a long way from the floodplains and water systems that underpinned Khmer power, and the Vietnamese had their own army, their own administration, and their own reasons to hold the line. Now, to the west, to complete the picture, the landscape that would later become Siam was still very much in formation. A patchwork of peoples and regional centres, some with deep Mon roots, others Thai-speaking groups that were only beginning to consolidate. Much of it fell within Angkor's orbit at this point, either directly controlled or operating under its influence. But these were not permanently subdued populations. That's the thing to take away. And the balance would eventually shift in ways that mattered enormously for Angkor's future. So this was the world that Angkor occupied. They were powerful, expansive, at times controlling much of this region, but they were surrounded by other states with their own ambitions. It wasn't a monolithic empire, but one that constantly needed to be negotiating its position within a complex regional order. Once again, though, the end of Suryavarman I's reign brought instability. The decades after his reign saw rivalries, shifting loyalties, and another reshuffling of power at the center. And while the machinery of the empire remained, who controlled it was not always settled. Then, in 1113 CE, a new king took the throne, and he will go on to be remembered as one of the greatest rulers in Khmer history. He built something that the world is still talking about. Angkor Wat. Even if Suryavarman II had achieved nothing else, you would still have to count him among the greatest rulers in Khmer history, because it was he who built Angkor Wat. Not just the greatest temple at Angkor, not just the greatest temple in Southeast Asia, Angkor Wat is the largest religious monument ever constructed. It has been a symbol of the Khmer civilization for nearly 1,000 years. Seen from above, and LiDAR mapping again has given us an extraordinary new view of it, stripped of all the vegetation and giving back the hidden impressions of houses and lanes, almost like an architect's blueprint of a city made real, the temple is surrounded by a moat 200 meters wide, bordered in sandstone, forming something close to a perfect square. Within that moat sits a large rectangular island, connected to the outside world by a single causeway on the western side. Walking that causeway toward the temple is one of those experiences that's difficult to prepare for. The central towers rise ahead of you as you approach, 5 of them, arranged in the shape of the 5 on a dice, climbing to a peak that represents the 5 summits of Mount Meru, the mountain at the center of the Hindu universe. The closer you get, the more the scale of it registers, and by the time you reach the temple itself, you've already crossed the moat, passed through the outer gateway, and begun climbing upwards, because moving inward through Angkor Wat also means moving up. Each layer of the temple sits higher than the last, and that design is deliberate. You're ascending toward the gods. When you reach the summit and look down at where you came from, it's hard to imagine just how much you are standing on top of. The temple mountain is surrounded by galleries, and one of them, the outermost gallery, is worth lingering on. Its walls are lined with bas-reliefs, the stone carvings running continuously along its sides. Cumulatively, nearly 800 meters of corridor. As you walk, scenes unfold beside you, almost like panels of a story. Battles from Hindu epics, processions of the Khmer King, armies on the march, celestial beings, and the famous scene of the churning of the Sea of Milk. Gods and demons pulling a great serpent to churn the cosmic ocean, drawing treasures and divine beings up from its depths. Another panel depicts the heavens and hells in extraordinary detail. And, hard to miss as you move through the galleries, are the depictions of these female figures. They're everywhere, and there's 2 types that mostly appear again and again. The first are apsaras, celestial dancers, born, according to myth, from the very churning of the ocean depicted in the bas-reliefs nearby. At Angkor Wat, they are shown mid-movement, hips turned, arms raised, jewelry swinging, as if in the middle of a performance in the divine court. The second type are devatas. They're calmer, more composed figures, standing facing outward from the walls, often holding a lotus, and their expressions are serene. Historians believe their elaborate hairstyles, crowns, necklaces, and patterned garments likely mirror the actual fashions of the women of the Khmer royal court back then. There are roughly 1,800 of them across the temple, each one of them slightly different. Evans and Co. describe walking around Angkor Wat as encountering a surface where almost no part of the monument is without decoration, like they've spread lightly a vast veil of embroidery over the entire structure. And if you, my dear listener, ever get a chance to visit, what I find so fascinating about this site is that you can approach a relatively humble part of even one of the most outer walls or structures. Not just the great carved panels or the soaring towers, but just a regular doorway or column, the blocks of even the moat embankment. Every surface has been worked to some decorative level. a true testament to the technical prowess of the Khmer people. And it's not a ruin in the normal sense of the word. It is a place that has stayed alive from its construction up until the present day. Despite being built nearly 900 years ago, Angkor Wat is still an active religious space. It functions today as a Buddhist temple and has done since around the 15th century, when Cambodia gradually shifted fully from Hinduism to Theravada Buddhism. But when Suryavarman II built it in the early 12th century, it was dedicated to Vishnu, and one of its most distinctive features reflects that. The temple faces west, which is unusual. Most Khmer temples face east, toward the rising sun. West is traditionally associated with Vishnu. It's also the direction of the setting sun, which some historians have linked to death and remembrance. So the suggestion being that perhaps Angkor Wat may have served, at least in part, as a funerary monument for the king himself. There is also something else about the temple that continues to fascinate researchers, and that's the precision of all of it. The geometry is extraordinary, and there's a strong evidential chain that the architects were paying close attention to the movements of the sky. If you stand at the right point on the causeway at sunrise on certain days of the year, the sun rises directly over the central tower, appearing to crown it. It's a moment that still draws crowds and crowds of photographers before dawn. But whether or not the full extent of the temple's astronomical alignments will ever be definitively mapped, the broader idea is not in doubt. This was a building designed to reflect the structure of the universe, to align architecture, mythology, and the heavens into a single sacred landscape. So Angkor Wat could be thought of as a cosmic diagram built with stone. While you can endlessly marvel at the design and the architecture of Angkor Wat, it's another thing entirely to try and comprehend the actual physical task of building it. Some of the stone blocks are enormous, many weigh several tons, and at Angkor Wat, the largest reach up to 8 tons each. Every single one of those blocks had to be cut from the earth, transported across the landscape, lifted into position, fitted together, and then carved. All of this in a tropical climate, over years, across the sprawling megacity that Yasodharapura had become. Before a single decorative detail was added, the sheer logistics of moving this much stone this far was already one of the great organizational achievements of the medieval world. And what kind of materials are they using, right? Well, one of them is called laterite. It's that reddish, iron-rich stone full of cavities and holes. If you've walked around Angkor, you would have noticed it basically everywhere. This stone made up much of the hidden structural core of the temples. Think of it like the concrete blocks inside a modern wall. It's solid and functional, never really meant to have been seen. On the surface goes the sandstone, these huge blocks sometimes, but it's smooth, workable, and capable of holding extraordinary carved detail. This is the material that gives the temples their skin, the grey surface you're looking at when you stand in front of Angkor Wat. Almost every inch of it has been worked by hand, although in some areas brick was used instead of sandstone on the outer surfaces, and that brick was often covered in something called stucco, a wet mixture of lime, sand, and water that could be spread across surfaces and sculpted into decorative detail, then perhaps painted or studded with gold or jewels. So what you see today as bare grey stone was probably really alive with colour back then. Now, the sandstone came from Phnom Kulen, roughly 40 kilometres to the northeast, the same sacred mountain where Jayadevarman II had performed the Chakravartin ceremony 3 centuries earlier. Huge blocks were cut directly from the bedrock with chisels and crowbars, then transported all the way down to the city, and you can actually still visit these ancient quarries today. But spiritually, there's something really powerful at play there, right? The rock is being drawn out of the holy mountain where the Khmer Empire started, floated down its rivers or otherwise dragged, and then turned into the fabric of the holy temples of Angkor below, sacred material shaped into sacred spaces. Once the blocks arrived at the building sites, another phase began. What's striking is when you look closely at Angkorian masonry, it's how tightly many of the joints fit, not because the blocks were cut into perfectly regular shapes, but because the surfaces appear to have been carefully ground against each other until they settled into place. It would have been slow, dusty, painstaking work. And then they had to actually get the stones up places as well. Picture that scene. At the base of a rising temple platform, sitting a huge block of sandstone weighing several tons, above it, bamboo and scaffolding climbing higher and higher as the structure grew. It's creaking in the heat. Somewhere up there, masons are waiting for the next piece. Ropes are stretched taut across these blocks. The men are leaning into levers as a block slowly begins to move. Getting it there required real ingenuity. The bas-reliefs at the Bayonne, another temple we'll talk about soon, does show sailors using pulley system and windlasses, so it's believed that similar mechanisms were almost certainly used on construction sites. Some stones show evidence of metal lifting clamps, while others have small holes drilled into them where wooden pegs could anchor ropes and slings. In some areas, earthen ramps were probably built up alongside the rising structure, allowing stones to be dragged upward along temporary inclines before being maneuvered into their final position. It probably didn't look that graceful or safe. Large teams of labourers hauling on ropes, men guiding stone with levers and crowbars, shouting instructions, scaffolding groaning under their weight, blocks swaying in the air above the heads of workers below. I mean, even modern construction sites are still dangerous, so in the tropical heat of Angkor, with massive stones suspended overhead and ropes stretching to breaking point, accidents must have been constant. Men falling from scaffolding, perhaps others being crushed. The serene beauty of what stands today was built on, surely, an enormous amount of human suffering that the stones themselves give no hint of. Running through all of this was a strict hierarchy of labour. The most punishing physical work fell to those at the bottom. Corvée labourers, people obligated to serve the state, those with the least power to refuse. Above them were specialists, masons, carpenters, metalworkers, sculptors. And what visitors see today is this refined artistic achievement, and it's the output of a vast coordinated system of human effort directed almost entirely by royal authority. The temples were expressions of devotion and cosmology, yes, but they were also the most visible possible demonstration of a king's ability to command the land and resources and people on a scale that left no room for doubt. One of the features that gives Khmer temples their distinctive appearance is worth understanding, because you notice it everywhere once you know what to look for. Unlike Roman or European architecture, which uses a true arch, wedge-shaped stones meeting at a central point that locks everything together, Khmer builders used a technique called corbelling. Each layer of stone steps slightly inward from the one below, gradually closing the gap until the two sides nearly meet. If you walk through the galleries across Angkor and look upwards, that steep, narrowing ceiling above you is corbelling. It's elegant, but it places real limits on how wide a space can be spanned, which is part of why the interior corridors of these temples tend to be relatively narrow, even when everything around them is monumental in scale. So when you arrive at Angkor Wat's western gate and begin that walk across the moat, as countless people have done, continuously, for the better part of 1,000 years, what you are approaching is not simply a beautiful building. You're walking toward the apex of everything this civilization had learned to do at that point. The mastery of water and land that fed hundreds of thousands of people, the organization of labor on a scale that could move mountains, almost literally, the artistic traditions that had been developing since before the first kings, the religious and cosmological vision that tied all of it together into a single, coherent, breathtaking whole. A king's power made permanent in stone, and it's still there, still standing, still visited every single day by people from all over the world. So while Angkor Wat still holds some questions, temple, tomb, observatory, probably all three, we do know that Suryavarman II was not alive to see its completion in 1149, and the temple, as magnificent as it is, was not his only achievement. He was the first ruler to hold a unified Cambodian kingdom since the 1060s, and he pushed its boundaries, diplomatically, militarily, and territorially, in ways that were genuinely remarkable, though not without consequence. So what did he do? Well, for starters, he re-established formal relations with China. Chinese records note embassies arriving from the Khmer court bearing tribute and gifts, and by 1123, the Song Emperor formally recognized him. Now, it's worth being clear about what that recognition actually meant, because the Chinese had a particular way of understanding the world. From their perspective, all foreign rulers existed within a cosmic hierarchy with China at its center, and receiving tribute from them simply confirmed that order. Being called a vassal by the Chinese didn't necessarily mean submission. It meant you had been acknowledged within their system. This wasn't the first time the Khmer had navigated this relationship, and it wouldn't be the last. For Suryavarman II, it was primarily a marker of prestige and legitimacy on the international stage. But it wasn't all diplomacy. To the northeast lie Dai Viet, the kingdom centered in the Red River Delta, what is now Hanoi. And this is a relationship that runs like a fault line through Cambodian history, all the way up to the 20th century and the rise of the Khmer Rouge and beyond. It is one of the most important and painful threads in this entire series, and we will return to it again and again. For now, what matters is this. For more than a decade, around 1123, Suryavarman launched repeated campaigns into Vietnamese territory, sustained large-scale attempts to break into a region that had resisted even the Chinese Empire for centuries. And they failed. The terrain, the organization of the Vietnamese state, and the limits of Angkor's logistical reach all played a role. The Khmer could not hold what they tried to take. The tension between these two civilizations, the sense of threat, rivalry, and deep historical grievance, begins here, and it never fully goes away. Khmer expansion in the west found more success. Up into the Korat Plateau in what is now northeastern Thailand, further north than modern Bangkok, even toward the frontiers of Bagan in what is now Myanmar. South into the northern Malay Peninsula, at its height under Suryavarman II, the Khmer Empire covered modern-day Cambodia, much of southern and central Vietnam, very large areas of Thailand and Laos, and reaching into the Malay world, one of the largest and most powerful political formations mainland Southeast Asia has ever seen. Across this widened realm, temples, roads, and administrative centers appeared, material markers of Khmer authority. At Phi Mai, in northeastern Thailand, a major temple complex rose along one of the most principal routes linking Angkor to its western territories, connected back to the capital by a raised royal road. Further south, on the edge of an extinct volcano, the temple of Phanom Rung took shape. It was reached by causeways, stairways, and bridges lined with Naga serpent figures. Think of these as nodes across a vast network, with Yasodharapura and Angkor Wat at its center. And it wasn't just Angkor Wat. One of the most incredible temples of the entire complex is Bong Mer Lia, about an hour's drive northeast of Siem Reap today. People often ask me where to go around Angkor, and I'll say this. Bong Mer Lia is one of my personal favorites. For years it was off limits because of minefields in the surrounding area, but it has been since completely cleared, and exploring it is unlike any other temple in the region. It's less manicured, more raw, and the jungle is still very much present, but there is a stairway that produces a different view of the temple than others that you will visit. It sits so far from the central complex that it could be thought of as a satellite city in its own right. And for those who do make the trip, driving past the classic Khmer-style houses along the road, the rice fields, the red clay soil, you can easily begin to imagine the whole area teeming with people going about lives that weren't so different from those of their descendants today, except that the streets and ponds and marketplaces were all radiating outward from this beautiful temple mountain at its center. Bong Mer Lia also has a vast rectangular reservoir on its eastern side, quarries nearby, and it has even been suggested that this temple was a smaller scale prototype for Angkor Wat itself. Closer to the central capital, Bon Tie Samre stands near the southern edge of the East Barai, another Vishnuite temple, reinforcing the king's particular religious orientation right to the end of his reign. After his death, he was given the name Parama Vishnuloka, he who has entered the supreme realm of Vishnu. The inscriptions about him convey a powerful image. He had seized power decisively, and one inscription captures that in vivid terms. Leaving the ocean of his army on the field of combat, he bounded to the head of his enemy's elephant and killed him, as a Garuda on a mountain slope might kill a snake. It's the language of a court that knew exactly what kind of story it wanted to tell about its leader. And in that, he closely resembles Suryavarman I before him, although a direct family connection is unlikely. Both came to power after disorder, both consolidated the kingdom through a mixture of force and alliance, both expanded the territory and linked those achievements to visible, lasting works that made their authority tangible, and it's almost a template for what a great Khmer king looked like. But it was another military campaign, this time to the east, that showed both the scale of Suryavarman II's ambitions and the consequences they set in motion. Champa had been a rival of the Khmer's for centuries. Its centre lays along the coast of what is now central Vietnam. In 1144 or 1145, Suryavarman launched a major invasion. Khmer forces pushed right into Cham territory, defeated the ruling king, and sacked the capital. For a time, Khmer authority extended over the region. But that control did not last. Cham power reformed, the territory proved impossible to hold, and that campaign would do something that would take years to fully register. It had given the Chams a reason to respond when the timing was right. And boy, what a response it would be. Suryavarman II had sat atop a unified Khmer Empire, and we can imagine Angkor Wat, the crown jewel of that empire, still under construction when he died around 1150. But his death exposed how much of that unity had depended on him personally. What followed was an extended period of instability. The word splintered feels right here. The inscriptions are fragmentary, but they point to rapid successions and contested rule. A Buddhist monarch appears briefly, then Yashovarman II, himself a usurper, is assassinated in 1165. That alone tells you something about the state of the court. Provincial elites began asserting control over their own regions. The network that had once fed into Angkor started to pull outward. And into that weakness, an old rival moved. Now, the story of what happened next is one of those cases where the familiar version is genuinely compelling. So let's tell that version first, and then look at what the sources actually say. The familiar version goes like this. In 1177, the Cham King launched a major invasion of the Khmer Empire. A fleet sails along the coast, turns into the Mekong Delta, and makes its way inland, up through the river systems, into the Tonle Sap, across the Great Lake that marks the southern edge of the capital. In some accounts, a shipwrecked Chinese sailor guides the fleet through waters he had come to know. The attack falls directly on Yasodharapura. Angkor is taken, the king is killed, the palace is looted and burned. And in fact, excavations later done in those areas uncovered thick layers of ash and charred timber beneath later constructions, meaning that this kind of rampage certainly did happen. The great city built over centuries was brought low in a single campaign. It's a great story, vivid, dramatic, and it has the satisfying shape of a vengeance story. The empire that had sacked Cham territory decades earlier was now sacked in return. But when we look more closely at the sources, it becomes less fixed than it first appeared. First of all, the date of 1177, repeated so often that it's taken on the weight of established fact, comes primarily from Chinese accounts compiled at a distance from the events themselves. Early French scholars treated these records as authoritative, and as we've already seen in part one, that approach had a habit of producing neat stories that didn't quite survive contact with the actual evidence. The shipwrecked sailor guiding the fleet is one detail that immediately raises questions. Historians like Michael Vickery have pointed out that the Chams were already deeply familiar with these river systems. They had fought, traded, and moved through Khmer territories for generations. So a campaign of this scale, depending on, you know, after it had set out, after it had organized all of the fleet and all the soldiers, but needing to rely on an accidental encounter with a shipwrecked man to guide them to where they were going, well, it strains credibility. And it's a little on the nose for the Chinese historians who were writing this history to have included in the story, right? Cham inscriptions from the same period add another complication. They suggest military activity was also taking place elsewhere, including campaigns against Dai Viet, which makes the precise timing and scale of any single invasion harder to pin down. So, what do we actually know about the Cham invasion? Well, at some point in the later 12th century, before 1181, Cham forces definitely did carry out a serious attack on Angkor. They reached the capital, they inflicted major damage, and struck at the political centre of the empire, precisely at the moment it was vulnerable. Whether this was a prolonged occupation or a rapid, devastating raid is still debated. But the ash layers are real, the disruption was real, and the effect on an already fractured system was real. What it wasn't, in all likelihood, was quite that clean, decisive, single-moment catastrophe that the familiar version describes. The reality, as tends to be the case, was messier, harder to date, and shaped as much by internal weakness as by external attack. But none of that makes what happened any less significant. The system fractured further, authority dispersed over the provinces, and for a time it must have seemed as though the Angkorian state, built up painstakingly over centuries, might not recover. But, as you can probably guess, it did. But it required someone extraordinary to make that happen. And as it happens, his story begins not at Angkor, but in Champa itself, in the very kingdom that had just brought the Khmer Empire to its knees. The man who would become the greatest Cambodian king in history has an early life that is genuinely hard to pin down. He may have been related to Suryavarman II, perhaps the son of a prince, but the sources are thin on detail. What we can say is that at some point, the young Jayavarman was present at the Angkorian court. And the court he would have known was not a stable one. As we said, there were rapid successions, usurpers, fragmentation. The point being is that he would have grown up watching the system strain and potentially even crack from the inside. And then, at some point, he left. Where he went is one of the more intriguing questions in Angkorian history. There are strong suggestions that he spent time in Vijaya, the Cham capital. Not as a prisoner, not quite as an exile, perhaps something a little bit more planned. Was he withdrawing from the immediate dangers of succession politics? Perhaps, maybe this was a strategic absence. Evans and Co. suggest that he may have been biding his time, and that doesn't feel far from the truth considering what later happens. But it does raise a fascinating question, because this is the same Cham court that would later invade Angkor and kill the king. So whatever Jayavarman was doing there, he was moving through the world of the very polity that was about to become his greatest enemy. It's hard not to wonder how much of what followed, the speed of his military response, the precision of his campaigns against the Chams, whether this owed something to what he'd learned during those years, that he had come to understand his enemy, if they were his enemy, from the inside, so to speak. He also appears to have spent significant time at a major regional city, what we now call Prea Khan of Kompong Svai, not to be confused with the Prea Khan temple within the Angkor complex itself. And this was no minor outpost. It had imposing walls enclosing an area that rivaled parts of the capital, and its outlines are still visible from the air today, cut into the landscape in the same rectangular patterns that define Angkor. The historian David Chandler even raises the question of whether this city was subordinate to Angkor at all during this period, whether it might have been operating as a rival centre of power in its own right. A portrait statue of the young Jayavarman was found there, which suggests he wasn't just passing through. A portrait statue of the young Jayavarman VII was found there, which suggests he wasn't just passing through. So who was he by this point? Was he aligned with the court, opposed to it, or operating in the spaces between? Was he building alliances quietly while the kingdom fell apart around him? The sources don't give us a clean answer, but the picture that emerges is not one of a passive figure waiting for history to hand him something. It's of someone moving through a fractured world with purpose, watching, learning, and waiting for the right moment. And that moment came with the Cham attack. When Jayavarman later described what he found in its aftermath, the language he used was quite stark. Cambodia, he said, had been plunged into a sea of misfortune, a kingdom heavy with crimes. A sea of misfortune? Are these the words of a skillful politician? This carefully chosen language of a king who needed the moment to look like a rescue? Or was it reflecting the real situation he had inherited? Probably both, but it tells you exactly how he wanted this chapter of the story to be remembered, with himself as the man who pulled the great Khmer Empire back from the edge. What followed was not a single dramatic moment of reclamation. It was several years of grinding consolidation, campaigns, alliances, the slow accumulation of enough authority to make kingship possible again. There are indications that he drew on support networks built during his years away from Angkor. When he appears in the record as a military leader, he is already capable of mounting coordinated campaigns. The fighting against the charms was serious and sustained. Inscriptions describe a battle on the Great Lake so intense that it was later remembered as turning the water itself blood red. He would later commission carvings of these scenes, densely packed boats, archers, soldiers locked in combat on water and on land, a visual record of the war that made him. By around 1181 or 1182, the process was complete enough for a coronation. Jayavarman VII took the throne at around 50 years old. And it is here that the things that would define his reign, and complicate it, begin to come into view. First of all, he was a Buddhist, a devoted follower of the Mahayana tradition, and from everything that inscriptions tell us, this was not a political calculation so much as genuine conviction. His chief queen appears to have shared it deeply. Buddhism had been present at Angkor for a long time. This was not something new introduced from outside, but what was new was the degree to which it was now brought into the centre of kingship itself. But this shift is easy to misread. Jayavarman did not dismantle what came before. The hierarchies remained, the patronage networks remained, Brahmanical practices continued alongside Buddhist ones. The court, slavery, the pursuit of titles and favour, all of that persisted. What changed was the language of power, how it explained itself, how it justified itself. Earlier Angkorian kings expressed their authority through temples and inscriptions that proclaimed divine proximity, statements that didn't need to reach the population to be effective. Under Jayavarman VII, those same kinds of statements are still being made, but they're now directed outward, toward the people. The population became, at least in the story he told about himself, the audience for his kingship, not just subjects contributing to his grandeur, but people whose suffering he claimed to have shared. One inscription presents him as experiencing the illnesses of his people as his own pain. Another frames his entire reign as a response to what Cambodia had endured. Across the empire, he established more than 100 hospitals, each supported by networks of villages, personnel, and resources. And this is where it kind of gets complicated, and where Jayavarman becomes genuinely difficult to reduce to a single idea. Because, I mean, take the hospitals for instance. Every one of them would have depended on villagers obligated to supply labour and rice, meaning that tens of thousands of people were tied into maintaining them across the land. The same king who claimed to feel his people suffering was also directing one of the most intensive building programs in Angkor's history. Roads, temples, reservoirs, rest houses, all constructed with extraordinary speed, all requiring the same extraction of labour and resources that had always underpinned Angkorian civilization. It's this double-edged sword. He's shown in statues as an ascetic, deep in meditation, but his inscriptions also praise his vengefulness, his political cunning, his ruthlessness toward his enemies. Was he sincere? Almost certainly, in some sense. Was the compassion also useful, a new powerful language for legitimizing a reign that had been built through force and political maneuvering? Almost certainly that too. The most interesting historical figures do tend to be both things at once, and Jayavarman VII is no exception, and he serves as an early frame of reference for other Cambodian leaders we will see later in the series, like Prince Sihanouk or even aspects of Pol Pot. But whatever we make of the man who would be known as Jayavarman the Great, the practical effect of his rule is visible above all in what he built. And what he built everywhere, across Angkor and far beyond it. Because Jayavarman the Great would build more in his time as ruler than of all of the other kings that came before him combined. Visitors to Angkor today will likely head north after seeing Angkor Wat, along a road lined with tall trees and thick jungle pressing in on both sides. And then, ahead of you, a large moat appears. There's a bridge which crosses it, and running along either side of that bridge are rows of stone figures, 54 on each side, lined up and gripping the body of a great Naga serpent, as if in a tug of war that had been frozen in stone for 800 years. This is the South Gate of Angkor Thom, the entrance to the great walled city within the city of Angkor. A Chinese diplomat named Zhou Daguan visited Angkor at the end of the 13th century and left us one of the only first-hand written accounts of the city at something close to its height. He recorded exactly what it felt like to pass through this gate, the stone faces above it, giant and serene, one facing the direction you've just come from, the others turning east and west, and they were brilliantly painted at this time, the central face covered in gold, apparently. What you see today is weathered and worn. What he saw would have been overwhelming, and we will follow him in the next episode. But even now, if you're lucky enough to have visited the region, crossing that bridge and passing under those faces, something happens. The scale of it, the weight of it, even after centuries of erosion and jungle encroachment, it still takes the breath away. When you try to imagine it freshly built, painted and gleaming, put yourselves in the shoes of a visiting dignitary, a merchant, a soldier, approaching this gate for the first time, the message would have been unmistakable. This was a great, powerful city. Once through the gate, the road continues into the basically downtown area of Angkor. Angkor Thom is vast. Its walls run for 3 kilometers on each side, forming an almost perfect square. And within those walls is not just a temple complex, but a living urban space with streets, ponds, houses, markets, and somewhere in the middle of it all, another crowd favorite, the Bayon. If Angkor Wat stops you in your tracks from a distance, the Bayon stops you in a different way. Right up close. It's not a single imposing form like Angkor Wat, it's more of a labyrinth that you can get lost in. A dense cluster of towers, each one carved with enormous faces, serene, half-smiling, looking outward in every direction. There's more than 200 of them, on towers that were said to have originally numbered around 54, positioned to face the cardinal points. The effect is of being watched from every angle, by a presence that's calm and impossible to escape, but it strikes as benevolence, not intimidation. These faces are most likely representations of Lakshvara, the bodhisattva of compassion in Mahayana Buddhism, the being who hears the suffering of the world and chooses to remain within it rather than pass into enlightenment in order to help others. Many scholars believe that Jayadevarman himself probably saw his own role as embodying something like this, and that the faces are maybe a deliberate blend of that divine ideal and his own likeness. The compassionate king, cast in stone, watching over his empire from its center. In its day, the temple would have been even more extraordinary. Likely polished and painted, perhaps adorned with precious metals, with a gigantic seated Buddha at its heart. There were other Buddhist and Hindu deities worshipped alongside it, because even here, even under the most explicitly Buddhist king Angkor had seen, the older traditions were never fully displaced. But it is when you move through the Bayon itself, past the towers and into the galleries, that something unexpected happens. The carvings here offer much more than what you'd seen before. Earlier Angkorian reliefs focused on gods, cosmic battles, the great epics of Hinduism. But here, the walls are filled with something closer to life as it was actually lived. Markets in full swing, people cooking, gambling, arguing, children playing, fishermen working the water. Animals moving through the background of scenes that feel almost accidental in their detail, as if someone was simply recording what they saw around them. There's a woman giving birth beneath a house. There are men of different ethnicities watching a cockfight. There are scenes so mundane and so specific that they feel less like religious art and more like you're looking into a window left accidentally open into the 12th century. These carvings are one of the very few sources we have for understanding what life actually looked like for ordinary people at Angkor, beyond the functions of temples, the elite inscriptions, beyond inferring what they can from scattered remains of pottery. And then you'll turn a corner and the tone will shift completely. Battle scenes, dense, chaotic, boats packed so tightly together you can barely distinguish one from the next. Archers firing across water, soldiers locked in hand-to-hand combat, bodies falling. These are the wars with the charms, the very wars that made Jayadevarman's reign possible, rendered with a vividness and intensity that still conveys graphic violence. The fighting itself would have looked extraordinary and terrifying in equal measure. Ordinary soldiers in the Khmer infantry carried lances, bows, swords of different lengths, knives, daggers, and a kind of large iron axe, a halberd. Crossbows existed but were rare. More imposing were the ballista, essentially giant mechanized bows mounted either on the back of elephants or on wheeled vehicles that could be rolled onto the field of battle, operated by two men and capable of firing arrows with tremendous force. Jayadevarman VII's reign also saw an innovation in the form of shield ramparts mounted on wheels, kind of mobile defensive structures that could be repositioned during combat. A standard combat unit combined foot soldiers, 300 to 400 mounted cavalry, and war elephants. The cavalry rode with saddles or stirrups, and in the heat of battle the mounted fighters would sometimes stand upright on their horses' backs. Their headgear was elaborate, eagles and deer heads, and the war chariots were decorated with nagas and drawn by pairs of horses. Alongside the Khmer forces were often foreign mercenaries as well, Siamese units led by Thai generals on elephants, and at times even Cham and Vietnamese soldiers were recruited into the Khmer army. And all of this moved to music. A huge gong struck by a dwarf, long trumpets, bronze castanets, blasts from conch shells. The cacophonous sound of a Khmer army approaching would have been unlike anything most people had heard in their lives. And this is the contradiction that the historian David Chandler puts his finger on so precisely. Here, on the same building, you have the compassionate Buddhist king, the ascetic in meditation, the man who claimed to feel his people's suffering as his own, and the warlord, whose path to power ran through some of the most brutal fighting the region had seen in generations. The serene faces looking outward from the towers above, the bodies falling into the lake in the carvings below. Both are Jayadevarman, and both are the Bayan. And when you head north of this great temple, the royal precinct begins to take shape in front of you. Jayadevarman restored the old palace after the Cham sacking. The palace itself was timber, so what remains are impressions rather than walls. We really just get the shape of what it was rather than the structures. But in front of it, he erected the Terrace of Elephants, a long raised stone platform running for several hundred meters, its walls carved with elephants in procession, their trunks forming the supporting brackets of the structure. This was almost certainly the platform from which the king appeared before his court, reviewed his armies, and observed the ceremonies and displays that were central to Angkorian life. Standing on it today, looking out across what would have been a vast open space of activity, you begin to understand how theatre and power work together, especially in this palace precinct. Just to the north of that is the so-called Terrace of the Leper King, named after a stone figure that was long misidentified as a king afflicted with leprosy. The figure is actually Yama, the god of death, but this large, intricately carved platform, with walls covered in densely layered figures, nagas, deities, and celestial beings, stacked row upon row, this is thought to have been the royal cremation ground. And there's something very extraordinary about standing there, knowing that this space was likely used for these kinds of things. And although the stone is now grey and faded, you look at the detail of the carving and think about the ceremonies that were witnessed here, and it's quite an astounding part of the Angkorian journey. From the centre of Angkor Thom at the Bayon, if you headed east, you will find yourself at the often less touristy Gate of the Dead, one of the five great gates adorned with faces similar to those of the state temple. Moving north along that eastern wall, you reach the Victory Gate, which takes you back across the moat and into Yasodharapura again, but now into a landscape where there are many more examples of Jayadevarman's building program. Because Angkor Thom, for all its scale, is only the centre of what Jayadevarman was doing. Start with Ta Prohm, the temple that many visitors make a point of crossing off of their must-do list. As they encounter a structure still half-consumed by the jungle, its stones prized apart by the roots of vast trees that have been growing through it for centuries. It has been left partly unrestored deliberately, and there is something viscerally powerful about it, the sense of nature and human ambition locked in a slow, patient struggle. But what most visitors don't fully appreciate is the scale of what Ta Prohm actually was. It was closer to a city in miniature. More than 10,000 people lived and worked within its walls in Jayadevarman's time, most of them connected to the Buddhist religious community. And beyond those walls, around 80,000 people in surrounding villages were tied to supporting it, growing rice, providing labour, maintaining the whole apparatus. 80,000 people for a single temple complex. Phraya Khan, to the north of Angkor Thom, operated on a similar scale, built on the site of one of Jayadevarman's victories over the Chams. It functioned not just as a religious center, but as something closer to an administrative and educational hub, a place where knowledge was preserved and transmitted alongside the rituals and ceremonies. Perhaps 15,000 people lived within its precinct, supported, again, by vast networks of labor beyond its walls. These were anchors of the empire, each one a concentration of population, resources, and royal authority embedded in the landscape. But if you went further out into the distant parts of Angkor, and indeed the Khmer Empire, even small villages would have a central temple monument that they would treat as an administrative hub. Now, Jayavarman also left his mark on the hydraulic infrastructure of Angkor, though in a very different way from his predecessors. His reservoir, the Jayataka, lies to the northeast of Angkor Thom. It's smaller than the great barrages of earlier kings, but still vast, and at its centre sits one of the most quietly beautiful sites in the whole complex. A bridge leads out across the water to Niak Pian, an island sanctuary dedicated to Lok Svara, surrounded by pools once associated with healing. Pilgrims would have moved through these pools seeking relief from illness, from suffering, from whatever they had carried with them to the water's edge. Today, the remains of the Barai are still filled with water lilies and life, and something of that original atmosphere, contemplative, a little otherworldly in the middle of this vast reservoir, remains. Further south, past Ta Prom with its famous trees and Tomb Raider vibes, is Bantie Kedah, a temple dedicated to a former king, which still maintains a community of monks today. Walk east through it and you emerge at Srasrang, a magnificent bathing reservoir that Jayavarman reshaped and monumentalized, with broad sandstone steps descending into the water. Even now it feels almost unexpectedly elegant, the kind of space that makes you want to sit down and stay for a while, like it's a very modern construction. But all of this, Angkor Thom, Ta Prom, Prea Khan, Niak Pian, Srasrang, it's just the capital, this is just the downtown area of Angkor. And Jayavarman was not only building at the capital. Linking everything together across the Khmer Empire was a network of roads that stretched through it. Not rough tracks, but proper engineered routes, raised causeways in some areas, built to remain passable through the wet season. They connected the capital to the furthest reaches of the Khmer territory. And along these roads, at regular intervals, stood what inscriptions describe as houses of fire. Their exact purpose is still debated, but the most likely explanation is that they were rest houses, way stations where travellers, officials, merchants, and soldiers could stop, shelter, and eat. You could think of them as the ancient equivalent of a motorway service station, but distributed across an empire the size of a modern European country. The very existence of this infrastructure tells you something important about how Jayavarman understood his empire. Yes, it was a huge collection of territories and provinces that could be taxed and controlled from a distance, but it was also a connected system that needed to function, move, breathe, and these were thoughtful gestures to facilitate that. You could imagine the people back then saying to each other, "Hey, this is nice." Far to the northwest, near what is now the Thai border, he constructed Bantiai Chmar, a vast complex that may have rivaled even Angkor Wat in scale. Its position was not accidental. This was most probably a garrison temple anchoring the empire's western frontier, and it combined the symbolic language of Khmer kingship with the practical function of a military presence in the west, particularly facing what was becoming the Siamese kingdoms. Much further to the east, at Prea Khan of Kompong Svai, where Jayavarman may have spent those years of strategic withdrawal before coming to power, you get one of the clearest reminders that Angkor was not the only city in the empire. It sits about 100 kilometers to the east of Yasadharapura, deep in forest, close to significant iron deposits, and for a long time it was assumed to be little more than a remote temple complex. But when this site was studied via LiDAR imaging, Damien Evans described a city appearing on the screen that had been hiding in plain sight. Massive enclosures, a barai with its own island temple at the centre, a Bion-style face tower, the same architectural language as the capital, reproduced far out in the forest. Connected back to Angkor by a royal road, sitting near the resources the empire needed, this was clearly a place where things were made and moved. The largest regional complex of the entire Angkorian era, and today almost nobody goes there. Now, back then, Jayadevarman didn't found it. The site goes back at least to Suryavarman I, but given his history there, it's hard not to wonder whether he had a hand in expanding it. A city he knew intimately, sitting at the junction of a major road and a landscape rich in what the empire ran on. Now, whatever it was to him personally, it was clearly something more than an outpost. So altogether, we have this picture of, you know, a vast road network, rest houses, garrison temples, far-flung urban centres and industrial hubs, all of it serving the same purpose, however, holding together a landscape that had so recently begun to fragment. Jayadevarman had watched the empire splinter under the pressure of weak succession and charm attack. He understood, perhaps more clearly than the kings before him, that Angkor's centralized power could dissolve back into regional fragmentation if it was not actively maintained. The network was perhaps his answer to that. Ways for expressing his power and sincere kindness in his mind, but also a mechanism for preserving the empire. And yet, and this is where David Chandler's observation about a dynamic of, well, on the one hand, but on the other, with Jayadevarman the Great, seems to cut the deepest. The very scale of what Jayadevarman was attempting to do and demanding be built was beginning to create its own pressures. His building program was so immense, so relentless, that toward the end, the workmanship itself seemed to have become uneven. Scholars have noted a haste in some of the later constructions, and that some of them just kind of end, as if the program was outrunning the capacity to execute it properly. He may have come to the throne already around 50 or 60 years old, and there is a sense across his entire reign of a man working against time, compressing into decades what earlier kings had spread across generations. The hospitals, roads, temples, rest houses, reservoirs, all of it required labour, rice, resources, and the continued willingness of the population who supplied them to keep doing this. The language of compassion was real, or at least it was genuinely meant, but compassion and extraction were running side by side, and the people at the bottom of that system would not necessarily have experienced them as separate things. No inscription marks the death of Jayadevarman VII. Scholars place it somewhere around 1218, when he would have been in his 80s, which is an extraordinary lifespan for anyone in the medieval world, let alone someone who had spent much of it at war. What he left behind was an empire at the outer edge of what the Angkorian system could sustain, stretched further, built higher, and held together more tightly than it ever had been before. When you walk around Angkor today and you see basically anything, there's a pretty good chance that it was built under the reign of Jayadevarman VII. Now, whether that represented a peak from which the only direction was down, or simply a moment of maximum extension before transformation, is a question that historians are still debating. What is not debatable, however, is that the world of Jayadevarman VII was a different one from the world that he had inherited, and that the forces which would reshape it in the centuries to come were perhaps already quietly beginning to move. The story of Angkor does not end here, but it does change from here. And luckily, we have someone who saw it firsthand and even wrote a book about it. Next time, this late 13th century visitor will be our guide through the great city of the Khmer Empire.